I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hello, and welcome to episode 247 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics in modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
We tend to think of freedom as an unquestioned good. More choices, more options, and more control over our lives. That all sounds like progress. But lately I've been wondering whether there's a downside to that. Here's an example. A friend of mine recently mentioned he felt stuck when it came to meal planning. There are almost endless things you can make for dinner, and somehow that abundance of choice made it harder, not easier. My suggestion to him was simple: add a constraint. In the colder months, for example, I make homemade soup each Sunday. There are still plenty of choices within that, but limiting the decision makes it easier to act. And this got me thinking about how we often do the opposite in more important areas of life. We tend to keep our options open, whether it's in our careers, where we live, or even in our relationships, because we're worried about making the wrong choice or even settling. But many choices don't just overwhelm us, they can keep us stuck. And at some point, the quality of our lives depends less on making the perfect choice and more on what we do with the choices we've made. So, Rick, let's start here. Do you think having too much freedom can actually make it harder to live well?
Absolutely. In fact, we only value freedom when we're talking about the ability to accomplish something that we want. The ability to accomplish things always takes place in the presence of certain forms of constraint. And so you don't want the constraints that get in the way of you trying to accomplish it, but other things that can be types of constraints place the sorts of limitations or restrictions that make the activity possible in the first place. So, for example, if we want to play chess and I want to win the game of chess, if I operate outside the rules and say, okay, let's get rid of all the rules for the restrictions and so that you can move a pawn, say, five spots.
And just take the queen.
Right. Well, then it makes it impossible to win the game of chess because the whole game is created by having certain boundaries, certain rules, that limitations. And so the freedom is the freedom to act within those constraints. And that applies to everything in our lives, that any activity takes place within a context, and the context is largely made up by what the limitations are.
And I think it's undeniably clear that you and I and anybody who's been living in most of this world for the past 50 years, maybe even longer, has so many more choices than our ancestors did 10 generations ago. Back then, you lived and died within probably 20 miles of each other, and you didn't travel much. Your job was sort of, well, what your parents always did. You just didn't have many choices. And I don't think any of us think going back to a world that's that constrained is good. But I think there was certainly a natural reaction to that. Finding ways to give ourselves more choices, give ourselves more freedoms, make the ability to not necessarily be stuck in the same profession that our father and grandfather and great-grandfather have been in, but charting our own way. I mean, those are all very good things. But I think the problem becomes, as the world grows and becomes more complicated, those many, many choices, for some people, maybe for most people, can feel a little exhausting and also create some anxiety, too.
Part of the problem with having too many choices, it requires too much cognitive work. And so you have a kind of exhaustion that sets in from the consideration of too many options. And so it feels a relief sometimes to say, okay, I've only got to decide between A and B, not between A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, which takes much too long. And then if I just select something at random, I don't really feel like I've made a choice. I've just lucked into something, right? Part of the problem, I think, is with the increased dissatisfaction of our lives, because we are demonstrably not as happy as our ancestors were just like 3 or 4 generations ago, despite the fact that we have all kinds of material advantages and, as you point out, many more choices. So what explains that? And part of it is this exhaustion that comes from having too many choices and then always feeling like questioning, like, did we make the right one? Or like, and not quite knowing, when do we stop examining options?
I think that's true. I would stack on top of that, though, using your options A to Z versus option A, B, or maybe even A, B, and C, that when you have fewer choices and you say, you know, I've given this thought and I think B is the right choice, then you're going to spend more time making B work and sort of living in that world. I mean, and you know, let's be honest, B may not have been the right choice, and you may really try to make B work, and option B a few years down the road, you may realize was the wrong choice, and then you deal with that then. But I think if you work at it and say, and spend more time living and trying to make your reality better versus spending a large portion of that time just worrying, wondering, trying to figure out which of those 20 options is best. I mean, that, I think, A, it's not productive, because at some point you have to make a choice. But B, I think you're not spending time on what makes life better and trying to say, okay, here's my reality, and how can I make that work? I think as I say that, some people are going to say, well, Scott's just saying settle, that, you know, you have A, B, or C, you're going to make the decision that B is the best choice, and that's just settling. And, you know, it's much better, in fact, to look at 20, 25 options, because you're just settling for the one or two or three that are in front of you. I don't quite look at it that way, but I think some people do.
And I would say, yeah, I'm settling, and I'm happy with settling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like there are these personality types, and one is the sort of person who says, well, that's good enough. Now, you don't want to have that attitude all the time, where anything that happens is just good enough. But it's a pretty good attitude to bring to a lot of situations in which you say, okay, I could endlessly try to figure out, like what are all the best choices I could make at every opportunity? Or I can just say, well, I'm going to pick something and then I'm going to make that work.
Well, I would say to go beyond that, I'm going to pick something that's not only good enough, I'm going to then try to make it better.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me give you an example of like, I had a friend in college who we had a group of friends. Whenever we'd go with this guy and he would be driving, his name was Tim. Tim would always look for the best possible parking spot. If we're going out to eat somewhere or we're going shopping or something like that and he's driving, he would drive around a lot endlessly. He'd be like taking 10, 15 minutes driving through the lot trying to find the best possible parking spot. And we're all saying, Tim, just park somewhere. We can walk in, because like, he would take much more time in the choosing of a spot than it would take us to park even at the back of the lot and just walk the distance to wherever we're going. And it was so frustrating. If you just drive to us and you take the first parking spot that's available, are you settling? Well, in a way you are. But you're also managing your time better. I think like having a multiplicity of options is not always good for us, because it's a matter of like, where do we put our attention? And I think knowing where to put our attention is one of the biggest factors that influences our happiness in the long term. Is what are we thinking about? What do we put our attention on? And then as you pointed out, how do we take what we have and work at making it better? That's a really good way to focus your attention.
And just one other example that comes to mind, and I may have told this silly story on the show before, but we moved into our house maybe 15 years ago now. And the house we bought was in wonderfully great shape. The previous owners had taken very good care of it, but virtually every room was white, which is a whole lot better than virtually every room being filled full of horrible wallpaper you have to spend time removing. But it was just like kind of a blank slate. So we knew we wanted to do something other than white. And you go to the paint store and you walk in and if you want to talk about being paralyzed by choice, it's, those displays of all the paint swatches and, how many kinds of yellow and blues and even whites. And one of the smartest things we did, and I think it was Sherwin-Williams, but I think every paint retailer does this, is they have these, instead of the little chips that are like, maybe 2 inches wide by 6 inches deep with the different hues, they also make these like 8.5 by 11 themed little books. And like, it's like ones like Cozy Cottage or, whatever they are. And we kind of thumbed through those and we found, and there's maybe 25 of those. And you kind of look through and you're like, oh, these are colors we like. And you open it up and inside there are like 6 or 5 colors that just sort of seem to go together. And these are presumably professionals that do this for a living. And we're like, oh, these colors we all generally like. So we just took that book home. And then for quite some time, like if we wanted to paint a room, we don't go to the paint store and look at the literally thousands of options. We took our little Sherwin-Williams book, opened it up and said, oh, yeah, this blue looks good. And this goes well with the other color in the other room. Let's just go with that. And that just made life so much better. And again, I think there's a lesson to be learned there about things that are a whole lot more important than paint color.
The dilemma that you described at the very beginning about the problem of a multiplicity of choices, that's exactly why those little booklets were created, because the paint companies were discovering that once they opened up all these options and they had this 300 or 400 colors to choose from, and you could select what you want, and then in the store they could take it over to the paint mixing machine and add the colors. That is really good for matching when you want to match an existing color. It's not very good for choosing from a variety of colors which ones you want. And so, like, customers were finding themselves paralyzed by too many choices. In the old days, my grandfather they were both house painters. And my grandfather told the story. He had a big crew of about 20 people that were working for him. There was one old guy that he had hired just to mix paint. And he would take these powders and he would mix the colors and then make sure that, like, the different gallons of paint were mixed about the same. And then they would call the boxing the paint, where you take a larger container, a bucket, and you'd pour 2 gallons in, and then you'd stir them together, and then you'd distribute it back in. So you're making uniformity of color. But in those cases, the customer wasn't saying, I want exactly this tint. They would say, I want baby blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's in the judgment of the paint mixer to kind of mix it, and you kind of take what you get, right? And so choices were much easier to make in those days. We've complicated things incredibly, because there's not only choices when it comes to paint stores, there's choices in ice cream stores,
grocery stores,
clothing stores,
online retailers. The other day I was looking for something on Amazon, which I thought was like a fairly niche item. There were like 50 to choose from.
Yeah. And how do you know that you've chosen the best one?
And I
think it's one of the reasons we have so much clothing waste.
Mm-hmm.
Like that occupies a big proportion of our landfills is discarded clothing because there's too much to choose from, and so people keep buying different things that they're certainly not wearing out.
I mean, and my firm belief is that, and again, this is a little oversimplified, but I think people spend too much time mulling about the right decision and less time about making the decision they've made fit their lives to make that maybe adjust that decision a little bit. Because, I mean, we can all think of important decisions we've made in our lives, and you sort of map out how you think it's going to go. And so often it never turns out like you think, maybe for the better, maybe for the worse, but there's things that come along that just upend it a lot. And I think that is the much more important part of life, is how you react to things that come along after you make that decision. And again, these are things that are clearly more important than paint colors or making soup on Sundays. But I think that we as human beings should be more nimble and react more and once we've made a decision, and not be so stubborn about keeping that decision and having the outcomes be exactly like we thought.
Yeah, so managing expectations is a very important skill to develop in life. And then also not living, as we dedicated a whole show to this, living with regret, right? Of course, there's going to be some major mistakes that we make over the course of a lifetime, and we'll live with those regrets, and they just won't go away. But as much as possible, you want to look at how am I moving forward, and what am I doing? And that's not to say that you make decisions and just stick with them no matter what. There's always time for revising decisions. With some kinds of decisions.
Yeah,
There's a lot of times. So I've got students who just graduated last week, and this is one of the things that I point out to them is, I ask them all, you know, a few weeks before graduation, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And some of them have really specific plans. I'm going to do this and this and this, and they've got all their hopes pinned on that. Other students will say, I'm going to do this next, and I think that this is going to happen. My ultimate goal is to get here, say, in 5 years. And I'll have others that say, I just don't know. I'm going to wait and see because I don't know what I want to do next. And I think the two extremes are really bad. You want to avoid them. One is the overly detailed plan, so that if anything unexpected happens, and it usually does within a five-year period in your life, you're going to be disappointed because it didn't work out according to your expectations. The other thing is just to think, I'm going to wait and see what develops, because if you don't set a goal and you aren't working and moving towards it, it's really hard to make course corrections. And so you need to set goals in life, and you need to have a certain kind of expectation, but they can't be too firm that keeps you from making appropriate changes. And this goes with their own lives. It's really important in raising children. I want my children to flourish, to live a good life, and we're going to make a lot of choices and see how they work out and how they help the children develop. But I'm not going to have overly restrictive expectations of just what's going to happen with them, because after all, they're their own person, and a lot of it is outside of my own control.
I want to highlight something where I am kind of stuck on and would be curious your input, is I think we agree that we can be paralyzed by having too many choices. And I think we can agree that having constraints on those choices is helpful and helps us move forward. What I'm unsure about is if it's better to have those constraints set by ourselves, saying things like, you know, again, I'll go back to the silly example of, I'm not sure what to have for dinner every night, but by gosh, we're going to have soup every Sunday in the winter because I like making soup and there's a lot of different kinds of soup, but that narrows my choices significantly. But that's like no rule that was foisted upon me. That's just a choice I made. Or are we better constrained if people make those things or make those constraints for us? And of course, the, you know, living most of my professional life in newspapers, the obvious one comes as deadlines. And I remember talking to a reporter years ago who covered city government in Wisconsin, but her previous job was covering city government in New Orleans, Louisiana. And she said one of the most frustrating things down there was, like any city, they would have public works projects, roads, bridges, sewers, all those things. And because it's New Orleans and it never gets all that cold, things would just kind of go on forever, that there was no deadline. And in Wisconsin, we all know that on or around November 1st, every road project in the state is pretty much wrapped up because it gets too cold to work and it gets freezing temperatures and ice and snow and all the things that come with our winters. So I wonder if, well, I guess maybe I'll ask it this way. For you, what do you think is more effective in your life, to sort of have these self-imposed constraints and rules, or do you think you react better to other people setting them for you?
I think they're both important, and learning how to live with both, because it's you live with them differently. So we set up for ourselves certain kinds of rules that we make for our life. So they aren't a firm constraint, because if we set it ourselves, we can break it ourselves. But I think it's healthy for us to set certain kinds of rules. One of the rules I have in my life is every Wednesday morning I have coffee with a group of friends. And it's appointments on my calendar, I keep it. But sometimes I can't keep it. You know, and so like I'm going to be out of town, I can't keep it. So I break the rule once in a while. But rule I make for myself, whether I'm feeling like going to coffee that morning or not, it's agreement we made with others. That's a self-imposed constraint, right? My wife and I, every on Sunday nights, we have classic movie night where we just decide, like, that's what we're going to do that night. We're going to watch a classic movie together. And so it has to be an older movie. So it's self-imposed rules, but it still allows us freedom within those rules to have some variability. That's kind of like you choosing
soup on Sunday,
that sort of thing. There's other kinds of external constraints that I'm really grateful for, even though they're really annoying at the time. And one of them is my biweekly deadline for writing a column, because there are certain weeks where I'm really busy and I don't have time to write the column, but I still got the deadline and I've got to get it into you at a certain date, right? And that's coming up for this week's column, right? And so I've got to get it in. That means I have to push other things that I want to do to the back or put them off. And if I didn't do that, there's no way that I'm writing 26 columns a year.
Mm-hmm.
I would write, maybe if I do it when it's convenient for me and when I have time, I would probably be writing something like 7 to 8 columns a year. And so it's a really good external constraint. And I only get that by making a deal, entering into a contract.
Commitment. Yeah.
Commitment. Same thing at work. There's all kinds of deadlines I have for things that I have to meet, classes that I'm teaching, all that sort of thing. And for the most part, those are really healthy. They're what allow us to, like, progress in life. There's a famous passage from the philosopher Immanuel Kant where he says, "The dove in flight imagines how much faster it could fly if only it was unencumbered by the wind." And of course, it's the wind, it's the air resistant that makes flight possible. But it doesn't feel that way to the dove. It feels like that's what's keeping it from flying even faster. And we often go through life that way, where we think, like, whatever we're experiencing at the time, that's a hardship, that's an inconvenience. We're thinking, if we could only get rid of this, our life would go so much better. But it's actually what's making the things we're doing in life possible in the first place.
Part of the inspiration for this episode was a podcast I listened to by Derek Thompson, where he and a guest talked about this very topic. And one company they spoke about, and I'll admit, I had never heard this about this company. And I just was checking now to make sure I remembered the name correctly. And there's actually a documentary that I may be interested in watching about this company. It's called General Magic. Have you heard of that company?
No, I haven't.
So it was, I'm just going to quickly scroll through the internet as we're talking here. But for those who are maybe not as familiar, there was a company that was founded in the early 1990s, sort of as technology was really starting to become a larger part in people's lives. And this company got a lot of funding, and they just had, and there were people there who in the early 90s envisioned in many ways what today's smartphone would be. And there were people in working for that company who really kind of understood what, like, the information economy would be like, and e-commerce, and all things that nobody was talking about in the 1990s. And all these really smart people were hired. But the fatal flaw of this company was not that they didn't hire smart people. They absolutely did. But they basically said, just go out and, you know, kind of brainstorm and get these ideas, and eventually we'll sort of form products around them. But, like, just get the, you know, just focus on brainstorming and coming up with these visionary products. And they did that, but they were never, like, given constraints. They were never given saying, we need to have a product in 6, 9, 12 months that can ship. And this was just a failure. That this company lost a bunch of money for these investors. I don't know in how many years, and you folks listening can look up the details online, but it just sort of disappeared. And it was a company I had never heard of, and it looks like from your reaction you had it either. But what you have heard of is all the products that these people created after they left that company. These were the people who created products like the iPod, the iPhone. I think eBay was on the list. All these people who had really smart ideas but were not in a system where they could say, yeah, it's great that you have an idea, but at some point we need to, like, stop imagining and start creating something. And I think that that's a really important lesson, whether you're starting a high-tech company, which few of us will do, or just, like, living our everyday lives, is that at some point you have to stop, like, imagining the possibilities and actually put them in practice in your life. And I think that's just an important lesson for all of us to learn.
I have an acquaintance who, over the course of his career, has written 3 or 4 really brilliant books. I've had conversations with him over the years, and he keeps having ideas for other books that he says he's working on or he wants to work on when he gets time and so forth. Most of them never get past the idea stage. And I've kind of figured out about him that ones he has produced, he produced because he was under a really strict deadline and because he had run out of money, and the only way he was going to get paid was he had to finish the book. And he was... And this is common, to a lot of creative people that like operating at that idea stage, but it's really hard bringing ideas into fruition. Without the constraints, for many people, it just doesn't happen. And so this sounds like what happened at General Magic. I think it happens to a lot of people. That's why when I'm working on a book, what I have to do is I have to create constraints, but I have to create some that are in a way external. If they're just in my head and I just give myself deadlines, well, I can always push back the deadline. So I tell a lot of people what I'm working on so that they will ask me
Well, this seems like I'm supposed to ask you, Rick.
Yeah.
So what? So you can share with everybody listening what is the status of your next book?
Well, I had been making some pretty good progress until the last 2 weeks, and I've got nothing done in the last 2 weeks.
And this is the one, if I remember right, and listeners to the show may remember, where you was it your grandfather?
Yeah, my great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather, who I believe in, grew up in rural North Dakota, but in that era, all of North Dakota, I suppose,
yeah,
was rural.
Yeah.
And you learned, like you do today, he wrote a newspaper column that was sometimes about North Dakota and sometimes about the big issues the world was facing at that time. And you've gone in and found most, if not all, of these columns, trying to transcribe them and talk about the lessons that you've learned from them. Is that about right?
Yeah, and I'm in the process of converting them. So there are columns written from weekly column from 1933 to 1942. And there's some weeks that are missing, but I think I've got around 420. They're all on microfilm. Some are very blurry. And so I can't use OCR scans,
yeah,
to pull it out. And so I have to go through and try to figure out what they say. And so it's taking some time, but I'm up to 1940. So I'm working through that. My goal is to do 3 of these columns per day. And that turned out to be way too ambitious because sometimes there's an entire week where I can't get anything done on it. But in a way, it's apropos of this very topic because he's always talking about the kind of severe constraints that they have on their life. For one thing, they're living through the Great Depression. Nobody in the community has any money. And so they're figuring out, like, how do they create some kind of, like, how do they survive, first of all, but then how do they create some kind of social life, some kind of community life? They're holding dances every week, and they're staying up till midnight and sometimes 2 a.m. going to these dances. And
these aren't like young kids.
No, they're not. Like, he was about 70 when he's writing this, like in 1940. I think he was around 70. So he's in late 60s, early 70s when he's writing these columns. And that's the age of many of his friends. But it's also a very intergenerational kind of activity. So he's writing about everybody in the community. Like, one of the recent columns I had been translating or transcribing concerns the new state highway that is going through town, and they're rebuilding the highway, but there's 2 curves that go on the road because the town is oriented kind of kitty-cornered to the direction of the highway. So there's 2 major curves going through the middle of town. So they need to relocate some buildings to straighten out the road. And then it had been gravel, and they pave it for the first time. Well, that greatly increases the speed, but it also kills the town because then people driving through don't stop in town because they're driving faster. They're making better time on this highway. They go on to the next town 10 miles down the road, which is much bigger, which is Carrington, North Dakota. And he reflects on that. They thought that improving the highway was going to make it safer because there were accidents that would happen when people would come through town in these curves. But now nobody stops, and so it's the end of this small town. And so it was the constraints made by, like, the gravel roads in these corners that made that small town and the small town life possible. Once they took those away, the town started to die. And so The whole thing from 1933 to 1942 is story after story of that. Like, what happens during this period in history when a huge amount of progress was being made and there was a vast shift in the nature of life from a kind of a rural small town life to what's becoming a more urban, more cosmopolitan life with the onset of World War II.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, what is your question for me?
Well, you may have read about this, Scott. Last week, Leon Botstein, who is the longstanding president of Bard College, announced his retirement. And his retirement was marred by revelations that he had carried on a significant financial relationship with Epstein over a number of years.
Jeffrey Epstein.
So millions of pages of documents were released, emails and everything else. He appears in these over and over. And it turns out he had raised quite a few funds for Bard College from Joseph Epstein. And we assume like Bard College had a radical transformation under this president's tenure. And so he did some really good things with the money he raised.
Some from Epstein, I'm assuming some from others.
Yeah, and quite a bit from Epstein. So the question is, if you were fundraising for an institution like this and had an opportunity to get a nice-sized donation from somebody who committed a felony, would you accept that donation, and would your intention or ability to do something positive with that money make up for the way the money was earned?
So my first and quickest instinct on this was yes, I would. But I also intuitively felt like that wasn't the right answer. So I'll sort of walk you through what I did here. First, I want to stipulate that if this money should be, if there's like, you know, open cases or like, you know, there's civil penalties that a person has yet to pay, and instead they're shoveling $1 million to you when they owe $2 million to victims of crimes the court has decided. Clearly, I think most everyone would agree that the victims should get money from, you know, in settled cases. So I think that's clear, but I don't think that's exactly the case here. So I hear about this, and my initial thought was that assuming Bard College is doing good and important work, which I'm sure it probably is, that finding ways to get money to continue that good and important work that will help people now and many years in the future seems like only good. If we decide that Jeffrey Epstein's a bad guy, which I think he absolutely is, well, taking some of that man's money and putting it to good use seems to not make him any less bad, but it does seem like at least the money's going to make our world a better place. But I, again, instinctively knew this was bad because, like, Bard got pushed aside when he retired for this. And there's plenty of other instances. And the other one that comes out quite regularly is whether it's Epstein or others, that political campaigns are often pressured to return donations. They may have taken a $5,000 donation from someone, and then a month later that someone is convicted of some awful crime. And they'll be like, oh, we've taken the $5,000 that we disclosed we took from Fred because Fred's like a real bad dude, and we've donated that to, like, maybe let's say Fred, like, you know, was a victim, you know, was the perpetrator of awful domestic violence. Well, they might take that money and devote it to a domestic violence charity. And again, you should be able to do with your money what you want. But at the same time, I'm just not sure. I still instinctively think that, like, getting money that is going toward a good cause is still probably okay. So I was trying to explore in my mind, and I will, in full disclosure, say that I was having a chat with Claude, an AI, and who was actually pushing back pretty hard on why I was wrong, by the way, because I'm like, this seems like fine. And I said, well, okay, what if you could make the donation to this? Like, if you're the fundraiser for this college and you're saying, okay, we want your money, you want to give us money, we know you're have some strings or some things in your past that aren't great, and you know you have some things in your past that aren't great, is there a way you could just, like, donate this anonymously? And, like, but apparently, and you may know this more than me, according to my little AI chat, that there are ways that, just because of reporting requirements, that you can't entirely anonymize those donations. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I don't think you can. I mean, there's money laundering, of course.
Well, that's exactly what Claude brought up, for example.
Yeah. But no.
But not meaning you don't have to go out and announce that, you know, this person gave us $1 million.
Announce it, but you disclose it.
There's a way that is disclosed. So I can, and then I'm like, well, then my other idea was, well, okay, so that's not good. So maybe could you have like this bad person who wants to give you money, donate it to like a foundation, and then the foundation grants you that money and sort of like, you know, in effect acts as a laundering agent for you, but like in probably a legal way. And again, it was like pushing back saying, no, that's still bad. So I'm still unsure why it's bad. So I guess your question was, would I take this fella's money if I was convinced the work I was doing was good? I think I would, but everybody, well, not everybody, my AI agent told me I was making the wrong ethical choice. I'm now going to wait to see why you think it's the wrong ethical choice.
Well, let me put it this way. You are probably, I don't know, we're talking about somebody fictional here. We're not talking about raising money from Jeffrey Epstein.
Sure.
But say if it's somebody like Jeffrey Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to develop some kind of relationship in order to convince this person to give you money that you can use for your institution. You're not going to lead out by saying, well, I know you've been convicted of some really bad things and we want to hide the source of this. What you're going to do is you're going to start flattering them.
See, no. That's how you fundraise.
That's how you fundraise. And so like the question isn't just would you take the money if they're offering the money? Would you be willing to enter into that kind of relationship in which you are very friendly with this person, in which you kind of compliment them on the house that they're living in, you go and stay with them and talk like how much you enjoy spending time with
which
them.
Which is some of what this Leon Botstein fellow was accused of doing.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
See,
And so for me, that's even more problematic. If it's just a gift and there's like no strings attached,
but
there's no relationship, I think that's one thing.
Yeah.
I think there's ways of justifying that.
And that's maybe what I'm more thinking of versus like there's passive fundraising and active fundraising. I mean, like there's some people who will just... I'm sure you'd wish this happens. I'm sure every university professor wishes this happens all the time. But somebody 40 years ago attended your college, had a great experience, became fantastically successful, and then one day calls up and say, hey, I'd like to donate $10 million to your institution. What's the best way to go about that? Those are like the easiest things that any nonprofit can deal with, right?
And which sometimes happens.
Yeah, it does sometimes happen. But more often, I assume, is that these people are sort of combing around and saying, which former graduates do we have that have been successful? Who in our community seems to support our mission? Things like that. And then you sort of build up those relationships over time that are different than the cold call out of the blue.
And then for you can imagine then for somebody like Jeffrey Epstein, there's a real advantage for him to be seen interacting with somebody who has a very good reputation.
And a good institution.
And a good institution and being a donor and then being recognized as a donor to the institution. And so it's one of the things that's really problematic is entering into that kind of relationship and then saying, yeah, but I'm doing it just because I can use it for good purposes.
Yeah.
Because that's
so, yeah,
that's messier.
Yeah. So I think now that we've talked this through a little bit, that I think I have very little problem with somebody who just contacts me and says, hey, I think you're doing great work. Who can I send a check for $1 million to? Versus sort of the proactive, you know, acquisition of fundraising capital from people who you know or in your community or who have been affected by your services. That's something I think is bad if you're dealing with people who have tainted backgrounds. But if somebody just calls you out of the blue and says, I read something or I went there or I just really like what you're doing, where can I send this check? I don't have a huge problem with that at all.
What would you say to somebody who, say, got an invitation to come and spend some time at Epstein's estate and then was given a donation, but then claims like they had no idea what he was up to. They didn't even know he'd been convicted of a felony. And is there, whether you believe that or not, is there an obligation to look into the source of that money and something about the character of the person who donates before accepting a gift like that?
Yeah, I think in those cases there probably is, and again using Epstein as kind of an easy example here, that yeah, if you knew Jeffrey Epstein before he was convicted of any crimes at all, and you had some sort of social relationship with him, and then you learned he's a bad dude, and then you like cut him out of your life. Well, I don't think there's any, you can't be blamed for like not uncovering his deep, dark secrets when you casually knew him 25 years ago or whatever that number is. But yeah, if you're fraternizing with someone and it is sort of turning into a transactional relationship, and I think you do, there is an importance there for people to do due diligence about these people, especially as you're spending more time with them and trying to extract funds from them. I know that sounds kind of, you know, clinical, but I mean, that's kind of what you're trying to do. I think that is a little different and does require a little more caution. And I think in the case from the story I read about this Bard College president, it sounds like at some point he absolutely should have known what Epstein was accused of almost certainly was involved with. And at some point should have stepped away. But I would imagine at the same time, this college president would say, but yeah, look how I transformed this institution and all the good. And again, I can't imagine it was all because of Jeffrey Epstein's money. I'm sure there were other funders as well. But seeing those outcomes has got to look pretty good. But I think you do have some responsibility if you're getting more closely connected to them versus just cashing their checks.
Yeah, and for me the big concern is the cultivating an ongoing relationship with somebody that like he either had to know or he absolutely should have known what was going on, and especially at the point that Epstein is convicted, he's got to know about that. That's not too hard to figure out.
Yeah, absolutely true. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column, which does give him stress from time to time, but can be found each and every other week on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.